This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Involved. Thank you, Joe. Thank you, Ian. I'm Dave Cohen in for Tommy Tucker. We're going to turn the conversation much more serious now because the conclave to pick the next pope is going to be starting soon. And we wanted to kind of recap the process and go over how this works. So we asked an expert to join us to talk about it, and that's Tim Gabrielli, the Gudorf Chair in Catholic Intellectual Traditions at the University of Dayton. Thank you for joining us, Professor.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
We learned today, actually, the timeline for at least starting the papal conclave, right?
Yeah, that's right. Canon law specifies that the conclave has to start within between 15 and 20 days after the death of a pope, and looks like it will start on May 7th.
And how does the process work? Obviously, if not all, most of the cardinals have already gone to Rome to pay their respects and to be there in the wake of the death of the pope. So now what is happening between the funeral and the conclave beginning with all of the cardinals in one place at one time?
That's right. So from around the world, they come to Rome, at least those who are able to make it. And as you may know by now, only the cardinals who are under the age of 80 participate in the conclave. But during this time now, between the funeral and the beginning of the conclave, there are these what are called general congregations, really meetings among the cardinals that are really about various folks giving speeches, their impressions of the state of the church and what's needed at the moment. And so those conversations are really important for sort of setting the stage of the conclave. And all the cardinals, below or above 80, participate in those, at least if they're in Rome. And then there's some more particular conversations that happen along the way. So this is really a time for getting to know one another, getting a sense of priorities, getting a sense of what folks think is needed right now in the church. And I think this is particularly important now, but then in the conclave itself as well, these cardinals getting to know one another. Pope Francis really pretty remarkably internationalized the cardinalate. So there are 20 countries that now have a cardinal that never have before. At certain points in history, cardinals were made up of almost entirely Italians and then Europeans. Pope Francis really emphasized internationalizing that body. So this is a really diverse group, and it's also a group that hasn't spent a ton of time together. And so this period of these sort of conversations, and then in the conclave itself, I think is a time in which those cardinals really get to understand their different perspectives and hear from one another about, you know, what the church looks like in their area of the world, but then also their views for, you know, what should be priorities in the church going forward.
You know, that's an interesting point you make, because we've been hearing in the news headlines that the vast majority of the current cardinals who will be participating in the conclave were appointed or selected by Pope Francis. And he was only pope for 12 years. And I say only, that sounds like a long time, but in terms of papal history, it's almost a blink of an eye. So I guess that kind of explains, with him expanding the cardinal ranks to all these additional countries, how he had so much influence with the current group of cardinals that will be selecting his successor.
Yeah, that's right. And I think it is important to note the high percentage of the cardinals who are appointed by Pope Francis. I think it's around 80% or something that have been appointed by him. But that we shouldn't conclude, like, you know, it's very difficult, I think, for us to get out of the mode of thinking in terms of party politics and things like that, right? It really isn't how these things operate. So we shouldn't think that, like, you know, this is equivalent to the number of, you know, Supreme Court justices appointed by one president or another from a party. I mean, it really doesn't operate like that. So to say that they're appointed by Pope Francis does have some significance to it, but it doesn't mean that they're all ideologically aligned or they all see things in exactly the same way. In fact, you know, Pope Francis, one of his emphases throughout his papacy was about the importance of staying with conflict and not hiding it or not holding back one's opinions, that really they should come to the surface. You know, we saw that in a variety of ways throughout his papacy, most recently in the Synod on Synodality, which is really this kind of emphasis on walking together and dialoguing through difficult issues. And people were anxious to see, okay, what's going to come out of this? The Pope obviously wants to, you know, through these dialogues, you know, the bringing together folks from around the world, bishops and others, the Pope wants to get something out of it. Well, I think the thing he wanted to get out of it was increased dialogue and allowing these things to come to the surface and for people to discuss them frankly. He said that often, you know, frankness. But so I think that when we think about his appointment of cardinals from across the world, I think they do, many of them have a sense, like Pope Francis does, of being primarily a pastor and being present to people. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they're all ideologically aligned or they have the same priorities. But it does mean that he's wanted those voices to be heard that sometimes aren't heard, and wants to hear the frankness of the bishop from or the cardinal from those places in the world that are considered unimportant, as well as those from Italy, as well as those from Europe. And so I think that the appointment of them by Pope Francis should not necessarily signal to us that there's complete ideological alignment there as well.
So on one hand, it's a less political process than we would talk about the appointment of Supreme Court justices by a president of the United States when selecting cardinals. But at the same time, you also talked about how there are these meetings, pre-conclave yep. gatherings of cardinals to determine what is priority for the church right now. That sounds like a bit of a political process.
I mean, sure, it's small p, certainly. I mean, there's always, you know, when people are thinking about leadership priorities, where things are going to go, there is always this sense of, you know, folks who tend to agree with some other folks a little more and some folks who agree with other folks a little more and who see things in certain ways. Absolutely. And I wouldn't want to lead you to think, and your listeners to think, that this means that, you know, everybody who's there has no interest in gaining folks to convincing cardinals to see things their way. And absolutely that goes on. And I think what unfolds in these meetings and these conversations and then in the conclave itself is all about those kinds of conversations that happen over lunch, in the hallways, after a speech is given, after a vote is taken when we get to the conclave, about, you know, okay, well, how do you see things? Well, here's how I see things, and what can we do? And maybe you should think about this particular candidate. Absolutely, those things happen. But I think it's important to remember that, you know, dividing the church or the cardinals into a kind of a simplistic sort of progressive, conservative, or, you know, liberal, traditionalist dichotomy is probably not as helpful. So absolutely, that kind of politicking goes on. Absolutely, there is the formation of sort of blocks, and folks are talking to one another who see other, you know, folks who see cardinals as on their kind of side or seeing the church and the world the way they do. Yes, talking to one another, thinking about who might be our candidate. Absolutely, those kinds of things go on.
We're talking with Tim Gabrielli, an expert on the papal process about what's going to happen with the upcoming conclave. When we get back, I'm going to ask him, what are the big issues that the cardinals will be considering when they select who will be the next pope to lead them? What are the things that they're talking about in these gatherings, and what are the big issues for the Catholic Church right now? And then we'll talk kind of nuts and bolts about how the process works, the different colored smoke and all of that stuff. Coming up after this here on WWL. Tommy's out today. I'm glad to be here with you, and I'm glad that Professor Tim Gabrielli is with us, the Gudolph Chair in Catholic Intellectual Traditions at the University of Dayton. This is the expert we needed to tell us what's going to happen with this papal conclave that now we have learned will begin on May the 7th. You were talking about how the cardinals, already in Rome, most of them anyway, for the Pope's funeral, are now talking to each other, getting to know each other, and discussing the future of the Catholic Church and perhaps what they're looking for in the next pope. What are the big issues that are confronting these cardinals as they see it for the future of the Church?
Sure, and I think we're just beginning to understand some of the things that are, in fact, becoming topics of conversation. I think just this morning, the spokesperson for the Vatican said that, you know, that some of the issues that were coming up in a morning session of those conversations were evangelization, which in short means spreading the gospel, which was a real emphasis of Pope Francis's papacy. Matter of fact, it's one of the things that was the center point of the talk that many think really got him elected, that he gave during these general congregations, that emphasized if the Church is going to be the Church that spreads the gospel to people, that makes the good news of Jesus's life available to the world, well, then it needs to go to the peripheries, as he likes to say, to the margins, that it needs to kind of not be shut up on itself, as he would like to say, closed in on itself, but out in the streets, not afraid to be bruised, broken, and dirty. And so that issue of how does the Church best spread the gospel in today's world, and how does it make Jesus's life available to people, you know, in a compelling way, I think continues to be an issue and a question before the cardinals. So Matteo Bruni, the Vatican spokesman, mentioned that. He also mentioned something that was important also to Pope Francis and frankly his predecessors over the 20th century into the 21st century. So is the relationship between Catholicism and other faiths. I think Pope Francis in particular had some really interesting engagements with Muslim leaders throughout the world. Actually, his conversations at Al-Azhar University in Egypt led to one of his major documents on social friendship, and so, you know, and we saw some of his predecessors, John Paul II, being known particularly for his engagement and development of the relationship between the Church and the Jewish people, as well as some other encounters. So that question going forward, the relationship of the Church and Christianity more broadly, the other religious traditions, I think, is one that's there. The other that Bruni mentioned this morning that came up is the ongoing question of clerical sexual abuse and responding to those developments as they come to be made known. In most cases, those are these developments about historical clerical sexual abuse, various bishops who have been involved in reassigning priests, or how various other folks in the Church around the world, these things have come to light from decades ago. How does the Church best handle that? I think Pope Francis himself talked about learning quite a bit and responding initially to some developments that were going on in Chile and he said himself that he didn't respond very well initially, and then had to learn how to respond. There's been some tension in the group that was established at the Vatican, a kind of task force on this, and tensions among folks involved in those questions about how best to respond. I think, of course, you know, it may go without saying among the cardinals, there's unanimity that this is a horrific abuse of power in the church, and historically was. And so how then to address that going forward? Those are three issues that Bruni mentioned that came up this morning. I also expect that they'll continue to talk about the structures, the administrative structures in Rome, which was a major issue as Pope Francis became pope. He's made some reform to those structures. I think that question continues about how those will best serve the universal church. And then this question that I mentioned earlier about Pope Francis's emphasis on synodality, which is, again, a Greek word that means to walk together, to be in conversation. It was a three-year discernment process in which folks came to Rome to talk to one another about pressing issues. That Pope Francis would say, hey, this is the essence of the church, that we talk to one another across various roles to try to come to understanding, that is really the essence of what it means to be church. And some folks, I think, see that as a little, you know, opening the door to kind of a lack of clarity, or, you know, the authority structures in the church maybe not being as pronounced there, though, you know, Francis denied that was an issue. But I think the kind of legacy of that going forward is something that's going to be on the cardinals' minds as well.
And these are the issues that we have seen and heard from Vatican sources, and that you know that are of importance to the church. And then I think to the more lay folk or to the, you know, the parishioners more, there are additional questions that may or may not be answered. We saw a lot of attention, at least in spurts, during Francis's papacy about the priest shortage. And there were questions even about, would this lead to changes in priestly requirements? And would priests be allowed to marry, perhaps? Or would there be other changes to try to attract more men to the priesthood?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a question, particularly in certain parts of the world. Pope Francis would always want to remind people that, you know, the problems of the U.S. and Europe are not the problems everywhere in the church across the world. So in Africa, for example, there is no shortage of priests. They're in abundance, matter of fact. And so in the Philippines is also the case that there's an abundance. So I think, yes, in certain parts of the world, that's a real question. And it's something that bishops in those areas of the world in dialogue with Rome are going to have to continue to think about. The question did come up about is there a possibility here for men who have been living a Christian life a long time, the possibility, as you say, of a married priesthood? It is already in the Catholic Church. Eastern Rite Catholics who are under Rome, but more influenced by Eastern Orthodoxy, spirituality, the churches that descend from the Ukraine and Russia and Greece, those priests are married. So there are Catholic married priests. It just hasn't been part of the discipline in the Latin or Western church. So whether that will go forward, I think it's a question that's on the table. And that one actually being a question of kind of discipline rather than a question of strict doctrine is one that I think could, if deemed necessary, change relatively easily compared to some other questions, but surely that's on the minds of many people.
We heard also talk during Francis's papacy about how to deal with gay marriage. And while he did not change church doctrine dealing with that, he did seem to indicate that it's okay for priests to give blessing to a gay marriage while not formally recognizing it in the church, if I understood correctly.
Yeah, I think that's close. There was an openness to blessing a same-sex couple. And then there was some resistance to that in some quarters, and actually, and a close advisor to Pope Francis worked with a cardinal and some other bishops in Africa to say this is not something that we're going to do here in Africa. And Pope Francis said, okay, well, you know, we don't want to again impose on various areas of the world things that seem to be warranted in other areas of the church. So I think, yeah, there's still some tension over that issue. And there's a question raised about, okay, what is it that a priest is blessing when blessing a same-sex couple? You're right that this in no way was a move from Pope Francis to say we're going to recognize a marriage among same-sex folks. What are we blessing? Are we blessing, if we're not blessing the union, are we blessing people? And I think there's some theological work to be done there. But it was, I think, a great point of emphasis from this Pope who says, hey, look, like, we need to meet people in their particular situations. And the job of the church is to be present in those situations and to recognize Christ at work. And insofar as we can, you know, make the grace of Jesus present in those, we should do that. And so I think in many ways that was an important bit of outreach, but one that still I think is relatively new and has to be kind of worked out theologically and pastorally.
So Francis did, while not rewriting any church doctrine, introduce some more, I would think, progressive thinking to some of these controversial topics, whether it be the pre-sex abuse scandal, the potential of, in some portions of the world, priests being married, in addition to those you already mentioned, blessing gay unions. Do you anticipate that, and does history show us that when we see a more progressive pope die, that the successor to that pope continues along that path? Or often, like we see in politics, do we see people ready to go the other direction after years of one direction?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, and I think it's really an open question. But I think that in some ways, you know, this is a long while ago, and it was a rather almost an arcane discussion, but Pope Benedict XVI, Francis's predecessor, made this comment on a plane that suggested that he said in an interview that were a gay couple to use contraception, that this would be an act of love. And people thought, wow, this doesn't make any sense. I mean, contraception is not only contrary to Catholic teaching, artificial contraception, but then also the question of heterosexual activity. Both of those things are counter to Catholic teaching. And here's Benedict saying something that this is an act of love, meaning that the kind of selflessness of the act, especially because, you know, of wanting to prevent disease, there's something to be recognized there. And I think, and this was a kind of side comment, almost like the side comment that Pope Francis made about, you know, when he was asked about a Catholic priest who is gay, and he said, "Who am I to judge? He lives out his vocation," and much was made of that. So I say that because I want to say that there are some concrete steps that Pope Francis made, for example, you know, the blessing of a same-sex couple. I think the distinction there is probably not blessing the union, but blessing the couple. But I mean, there are ways in which, if we look back, we see various seeds planted from his predecessors that are in that direction. Certainly, when it comes to economic issues or the question of climate change, you know, Pope Francis in 2015 published the first extensive thematic document on care of our common home, on responding to climate change. But Pope Benedict XVI actually had said a number of things in that same direction that would be regarded, I think, in the U.S. as pretty quote unquote progressive in that respect. And he was building on some of the things that his predecessor had said as well. And then economically, you know, there were some reactions to Pope Francis that said, "Oh, he's a socialist, he's a communist." Especially in his critiques of the market and of economic liberalism, especially unfettered free market economics. Well, my goodness, I mean, we look at what Pope Benedict had to say about those matters, and there's a lot of continuity. So I think sometimes we maybe need to see a little bit more broadly the ways in which the Catholic Church as a whole doesn't necessarily line up with our political categories. But the question remains as to, you know, would there be a pope, for example, who might be someone who would come back to the emphasis on Europe as identified in some particular way with Christian heritage, whereas Pope Francis's emphasis was much more on a global church, internationalizing the church. That could be the case. But again, I think it's something that the cardinals are really going to have to discern about, you know, continuity with Pope Francis's particular emphases, or whether it may be the case that picking up on some of those emphases, his successor goes in some other directions.
Talking with Professor Tim Gabrielli about the process of picking the next pope. When we come back, we'll talk about some of the actual nuts and bolts of how this works, where they meet, when they meet, what the smoke means, and how that process unfolds. And are there any leading candidates? And will there ever be an American pope? All of that after this. Check on traffic on WWL. 9:46 on your Monday morning, Dave Cohen in for Tommy Tucker, joined by Tim Gabrielli, the Gudolph Chair of Catholic Intellectual Traditions at the University of Dayton, helping us explore what will happen with this papal conclave for the Catholic Church beginning May 7th. So physically, what happens on May 7th, Professor?
Sure. Yeah, the cardinals participate in a mass, an opening prayer service, invoking particularly the Holy Spirit. So it's important to remember, I think, there are plenty of human elements to this process, but for the cardinals, this is really about in and through those human processes, trying to understand where God is leading them and selecting the next pope. So it begins with the mass, invoking the Holy Spirit. And then the cardinals are locked in the Sistine Chapel. That's so conclave means with key, and the idea being that they are cut off from conversation with everyone else. There will be, I think, some protocols in place to be away from electronic devices, whether cardinals sneaks a look at a phone or not.
People were taking selfies with the Pope's body, but I can't see the cardinals taking selfies in the conclave, huh?
That would be a real problem, I think. And I think that the canon law specifies that, you know, a cardinal who would break this secrecy is automatically excommunicated. So there's serious consequences. They begin with one vote on the first day, and the process is that these votes are brought forward and put in this big chalice urn sort of thing, and their physical votes dropped in. Everybody walks up and drops in their vote, and then they're counted aloud so that everybody knows kind of where the results stand and can understand who's getting some support and what level of support. Of course, we have to reach a two-thirds majority here of about 100. It looks like there will be 132. There are 135 cardinal electors. It looks like two will not be present due to health conditions, and one by Pope Francis, who was involved in a financial scandal, his voting rights were taken away. So two-thirds of 132 to get there is what's required to become pope. So reading the results out loud is actually an indication to the cardinals, a sort of holding up a mirror back to them of where they stand, and becomes the starting point of the conversations that go on. So one vote on the first day, and then on subsequent days, two votes in the morning, two in the afternoon. After, if a pope is not elected, those ballots are mixed with some sort of substance. I'm not sure exactly what they use, but so that the burning of the ballots creates black smoke, and this is, you know, the what everybody watches for outside is the smoke emerging from the chimney, and black indicates that there has not been a pope elected yet, and when eventually there is a pope elected, the smoke should be white. I think it was when Pope Benedict was elected, it was kind of grayish, and everybody wondered, is
yeah,
that
yeah, I remember
pope?
That vividly. Everyone going, wait, is that white? Is that black? Wait, what does gray mean?
So they fixed that, it seems, with Pope Francis. They got a better mix of concoction of whatever they put in there. So 2 in the morning, 2 in the afternoon. If we go for 3 days and a pope isn't elected, then they take a break of a day to pray and to talk and to kind of refocus and then pick up again.
It's about 88 votes that are necessary. So black, no pope, white, a pope has been selected. And then how long does it take them after you see the white smoke to announce who is the next pope?
Yeah, probably within an hour, maybe two. You know, the process is that it's usually the dean of the College of Cardinals, who's the same pope that celebrated the funeral, whose role it is to kind of administrate the conclave. But that's Cardinal Giovanni Battista Re, but he is 91, so he will not be participating in the conclave. So it falls to Cardinal Parolin, who's very close to Pope Francis, was his Secretary of State, who will be administering the conclave. And he's the one who goes to the elected cardinal and says, will you accept? And then once he accepts, he's immediately pope. But then there's some processes behind the scenes of each of the cardinals coming up and pledging their fidelity to the pope. So that takes some time. Outfitting the pope in his white cassock, that takes some time. The pope chooses a name. And then when all those processes are in place, they'll appear.
That all has to happen within a couple of hours. They must have a very good tailor, and the cardinals. The cardinals must be thinking very hard about what their papal name would be if they were elected. For all of that
That's
to
right.
happen that quickly, yeah. So
we are in Rome. There are lots of good tailors in Rome. So,
yeah, so I hear.
Be.
Yes. that having been said, there are sites out there where you can bet on who will be the next pope. And I don't know how much legitimacy there is, but they'll take your money, and apparently they will pay out if you get it correctly. And just out of curiosity, I had our in-house producer take a look at that. And it's interesting, if not accurate, it's still interesting, that Luis Antonio Tagle of the Philippines is apparently where the odds-on favor is to be the next pope, which to me the most intriguing thing there is he's not Caucasian. He is an Asian gentleman. Are there any chances that we would see a non-Caucasian pope, and will there ever be an American pope?
Okay, so first, I think he says his name Tagle from the Philippines. He's pretty interesting that he's very close to Pope Francis, very articulate about Pope Francis's vision. He's given a number of talks and papers that really kind of expound, help people to understand what Pope Francis is all about. Has been very very expressive about that and recognized for being able to be sort of in tune with what Pope Francis has been trying to do. So he's charismatic. The church in the Philippines is very vibrant. He's had people's attention for a while. He was the head for a bit of Caritas Internationalis, Caritas International, which is it's the second largest international aid organization run of any. I mean, this is run by the Catholic Church that provides charitable aid to people around the world. And there was kind of a shakeup there. Of course, we don't know all the details. I think Tagle himself called for an external review of the organization, the result of the its structures, you know, its administrative structures, how it was doing its work. And then as a result of that external review, Tagle and his whole staff were dismissed by Pope Francis. And so we don't know the whole story. It seems that maybe his number two was kind of ruling with a bit of an iron fist and irritated a lot of people working in that office. So that was kind of raised a number of questions. I mean, that was a few years ago about, you know, is this an administrative, sort of shortcoming evidence of it, or is something else going on? I think probably folks who are closer to it, and the cardinals certainly know
more than we do, clearly.
Right.
And Professor, I hate to cut you short. We're running out of time. But very quickly, do you think there are chances to see a non-Caucasian pope this time around? Do you think that's possible?
Yes, absolutely, it's possible. Pope Francis is the first pope from Latin America, from the global south. I think that's certainly possible. It could be from Africa, could be from Asia.
Africa,
I think
we could see a black pope.
Absolutely,
wow.
It's possible.
All right, well, I'm going to have to end you right there. A yes or no, will we ever see an American pope?
No.
No, okay. Professor, I appreciate your honesty. A lot of other people share that thought. Well, I know we're going to, Professor Tim Gabrielli, we're going to talk to you again before we get to this conclave, and I'm sure throughout it. So thank you for your expertise and joining us here on WWL. Have a great day.
You too. Pleasure to be with you.
All right, we'll see what is coming up on the Newell Norman Show right after this, folks.